High-income assets you might never have thought of, what you're really paying for with your fund charge, and top-performing income funds. Welcome to the Personal Finance Podcast with me, Kate Bearley. Today, I'm joined in the studio by Emma Adjaman, personal finance writer, and Jason Hollins, managing director at Tilney Group. So first, income without high risk. It's the holy grail of investing for many. And Emma has been looking at a whole host of income assets and funds which could deliver you just that. All of them are in areas which you might never have thought of too. So Emma, you've been looking at what we call alternative income, haven't you?
Yeah.
So what defines alternative income and what kind of areas have you looked into?
Basically, alternative income can be thought of as income you receive from asset classes outside the obvious equities or bonds. And as you mentioned, there are a whole host of areas. I've only looked at three in this article, full of, we've only got so much space. But they are property, infrastructure and renewable energy. And in some areas, these are issues that investors haven't really thought about as paying good income. So this is an area to consider.
Okay. And what kind of yields are we talking about, generally speaking?
Well, this is one of the main attractions for this area. So, for example, the average UK direct property trust is yielding about 4.5%, which is quite high. Infrastructure trust yields around 4.8%, and renewable energy trusts are even higher at 5.7%.
Okay, so that is pretty high. So let's start with property. So people are familiar with the idea of investing in property funds, but the ones you've looked at are not the obvious, are they? So what kind of specialist property funds have you been looking at?
Yeah, so as you say, most people are familiar with well-known commercial property trusts where you're investing in things like office blocks or shopping centres. But these new breed of specialist property trusts are sort of making money in areas such as student accommodation, care homes and warehouses.
Okay, so let's take the warehouses, or they're sometimes called big boxes, aren't they? Take that first. So what are big boxes and why is it such a kind of growing area?
Well, big boxes are basically huge warehouses that online retailers use to store their goods before sending them out to customers. And we all know, the growth of internet shopping doesn't seem to be tailing off in any way. So there's huge demand for these spaces, and trust that invest in them can get a good income from that.
Okay, and which one have you looked at there?
Yeah, so looked at Tritax Big Box REIT, which is, was the first one to launch in this area. And its assets have increased 979% from its launch in 2013, from £200 million to more than £2 billion today.
Okay, wow, that's pretty impressive. And you also talk about student property, don't you? And I assume that these aren't the kind of rat-infested halls that we that some of us might have stayed in at university?
No, quite the contrary. A very different experience. Often these buildings are, developed for wealthy overseas students. So they tend to be new, very modern, very luxury in some cases.
Okay. And what are the benefits of these kind of property funds? Why are the yields so high and how sustainable are those dividends?
Well, if you think about student accommodation, the UK is a really attractive destination for overseas students, particularly London. And so demand is high from that side of things. And also you've got limited supply. So there's potential for high grain income because you've got the ability to charge higher rents.
Okay. So, Jason, which of these property funds specifically comes with the biggest risk, do you think?
There are so many of these niche vehicles. I think the thing to be careful of is also, whether these investment companies are using high levels of gearing. So for most investors, actually, we would still, I'd still suggest using a more conventional commercial property investment company. UK Commercial Property Trust looks pretty reasonable at the moment. It's only at a 1.2% premium and it has a 4.1% yield. I would still focus on those types of more broader commercial property trusts as opposed to those that are investing in a sort of niche subsector of the property universe.
Okay, and I mean, just talking of those broad commercial property trusts, they obviously had major issues when the open-ended funds suffered last year and were gated. The trusts were obviously affected by that sentiment too. Were these niche property vehicles affected as well?
Well, there's very little trading in the secondary market of it, because these tend to be quite small issues. So yes, we did see in the days immediately following the EU referendum that there was some panic by investors, and they began selling both property investment companies and open-ended funds, and that meant the investment companies obviously moved quite quickly to very big discounts to NAV. But these areas are all trading back at premiums again. So that on reflection was actually a buying opportunity to get into some of these vehicles that, you know, do typically trade at quite big premiums. But it tended to be the more widely held, more conventional property investment companies that got squeezed.
Okay. Let's move on from property. And Emma, let's talk about infrastructure, which is another area that you've looked at. What are these kind of funds, and what are their main benefits?
Well, infrastructure has a range of assets. For example, it can include the construction, operation of schools, hospitals, transport, any kind of infrastructure projects. Traditionally, many of the projects used a public-private partnership model, PPP, which meant they also benefited from very secure government-backed income streams.
Okay. And what's an example of a fund in this area then?
One of the examples is GCP Infrastructure. And actually, it's a little bit different because it only focuses on investments in UK infrastructure debt. So it includes assets such as PPP projects, but also solar and wind generation. And it has the highest dividend yield in the sector of around 6%.
Okay. And these tend to be inflation linked, don't they, some of these?
Yes, that's right. Because many of the underlying projects will have inflation linkage to the income streams. So that's one of the key attractions of this area, that as inflation goes up, you know, your income's also going to go up.
Okay, interesting. What about the key risks then?
Well, as Jason was saying, one of the key risks is that because these assets are perceived as relatively low risk, but they've got such a high yield attached to them, they're tending to be trading on very high premiums. So GCP Infrastructure, for example, is trading on a premium of around 15%. And that obviously can be a potential worry for investors if, you know, they buy at the top of the market and later on, for some reason, some of these premiums fall. Another kind of issue to be concerned about is that some of the infrastructure trusts are struggling to find PPP assets at a good price, as the amount of PPP projects available has fallen. But demand is still sky high, so everything's just getting more expensive.
Okay, interesting. And Jason, we do hear that interest rate rises could affect these kind of funds. Why is that?
Because yield is such an important element of the overall return profile. And obviously, if yields start to rise both on interest rates and then on, you know, more mainstream investments like government bonds or corporate bonds, then clearly the market reprices other income assets. So there is a sensitivity there. Although it is fair to say in the area of property, for example, property in many ways, or commercial property as opposed to residential property, has both fixed income and equity-like characteristics. So by that, what I mean is that on the one hand, rising interest rates have a negative impact for yield-based investments like a property trust. But equally, they are very sensitive to economic strengthening. So in an environment where rates start to rise, that's usually an environment actually where the economy is picking up quite strongly and growth is picking up. So on the one hand, you know, you could argue that a rising rate environment is a negative, but actually that would likely happen in an environment where the economy is picking up, where rents can therefore rise because actually occupancy rates are high. So actually, I think, you know, a commercial property has the ability to absorb, you know, modest rate rises. If you saw an environment of, you know, very sharp interest rate rises, that would be a different kettle of fish. But I think, you know, very few people would expect that.
Okay, so kind of a mixed picture there. And Emma, the final area that we'll have a look at here is renewable energy. This similar to infrastructure, I would assume. And why do these generate such good income streams?
They are similar in some senses because they receive quite a lot of their income streams from government subsidies. So, for example, these trusts will typically invest in wind farms and solar farms. One of them also invests in waste management. And the whole point of the projects they have is power generation, for which they will receive some government income through subsidies. But they also receive part of their income, you know, based on the price of power. And that's one of the risks with these areas, because that's actually quite variable.
OK, and I mean, how dependent are these on subsidies? Is that a risk too?
Yes, I mean, to some extent, it is a risk. It's various of that. Different kind of trusts have greater or less exposure depending on the kind of areas they invest in. So it does make sense for investors to kind of like look into the detail of how their trusts invest and how much exposure they have to subsidies. But in general, if subsidy levels of, you know, go down, these trusts' ability to generate the income that they are able to will be affected.
Okay. And what are the yields and the premiums like on these kind of trusts then?
They're also trading at very high premiums because the yield is very high. So on average, the sector is yielding about 5.7%. And the average premium is 10.2%. But having said that, that's lower than the other broader infrastructure trusts, which, as we say, is around 12.5%.
Right. So, I mean, these are high premiums, aren't they, Jason? Do you think it's, well, when is it worth paying that kind of premium for these kind of funds? Is it ever worth it, or should you wait for them to come down?
I think that, you know, personally, I would be reluctant to pay double-digit premiums. But I think, you know, the opportunity comes when these types of vehicles do fundraising. And certainly the sort of broader infrastructure investment companies have been through a round of fundraising, you know, in recent months. So I think, you know, if you're thinking of investing in these areas, it's a question of, you know, keeping an eye on when they're going to do further fundraisings and trying to get in at that point in time.
Okay.
But I'd be reluctant to pay double-digit premiums, you know, for these types of income streams.
Yeah. I mean, to what extent do you think income investors do need to look further afield and kind of move away from just, for example, UK equity income and bonds?
I mean, I think, well, they definitely need to do that. You know, historically, private investors in the UK have been big fans and big buyers of UK equity income funds, with good reason, because, you know, the UK has historically been a really high-yielding market. But I think, you know, it's worthwhile bearing in mind that actually the UK outlook for UK dividends is facing some headwinds at the moment. Payout rates are, you know, are extremely high. Last year, around about 89% of UK companies' earnings were distributed as dividends, and that means inevitably that there's very limited headroom for further significant dividend growth unless profits really start to motor. But I think, you know, key parts of the UK dividend pool, you know, come from areas like oil and gas. You know, that is singularly probably the biggest source of overall dividends in the UK. And as you know, the energy prices have been very volatile. There were hopes and expectations that the oil price would begin to pick up. But obviously, more recently, it's weakened again.
Yeah, so there is certainly a need to kind of move away from things that we might have previously thought of as kind of safer ports for income, basically.
If you look over the last decade, typically around two-thirds of the entire UK dividend pot has come from 15 companies, and around about, you know, over a third of that actually comes from the five biggest companies. You know, and so you do see most bog standard UK equity income funds, you know, often have the same old names in their top 10 holdings, which would include the banks like HSBC and Lloyds, would include Royal Dutch Shell and BP, you know, might have the pharmaceutical giants like Glaxo in there. So, you know, if you've been buying these steadily over many years, you've probably got a lot of exposure to actually the dividend income of quite a small cluster of companies. So it does, I think, make sense to look further afield. That means both perhaps looking at smaller company income funds, but also looking at overseas equity markets and maybe having a little bit of exposure to some of these more alternative income vehicles.
Okay, well, we'll actually come back to some of those points a bit later, but now we're going to move on and look at fund investment charges and just what you get for your money. I've been looking at why some funds cost so much more than others and what's inside the ongoing charge. So Jason, generally speaking, as an investor, what do you have to pay when you buy funds?
Okay, well, the costs of when you buy a fund are, well, first of all, the costs of either a broker or a platform or advisor who you purchased it through. That's an important part of the total cost of purchasing. But then obviously a fund running cost will include the annual management charge, which is the percentage-based fee, typically, that the fund company will charge investors for running the fund. But on top of that, there are other costs that to be included. And that's usually expressed as a formula called the OCF, the ongoing cost formula. And those additional costs beyond the annual management fee represent things like perhaps, you know, research that's billed against the fund, certain administrative costs or auditing costs. And those are sort of fixed in nature. Therefore, you know, bigger funds tend to see, they tend to make less of an overall influence on very big funds. But obviously on a small fund, they can actually make up quite a bit of extra cost. Now, these days, if you bought an equity fund, 0.75% is very much the sort of standard annual management charge. But those additional costs that I spoke about might actually increase the overall cost to around about 0.85%. But it can vary significantly depending on the size of a fund or indeed whether it's operating in a very specialist area.
Okay. Now, I've had a look at the sectors, the fund sectors that are the cheapest and most expensive. And when looking at open-ended funds, I found that the cheapest ones by OCF, by average OCF, were short-term money market funds and bond funds. So those all range between 0.55% to 0.24%. So does that surprise you, or is that exactly what you'd expect to see?
That's exactly what I would expect, because those types of markets are less complicated. The cost of operating, of a fund manager operating those markets are going to be lower. And the return profile is lower, so charges make an even bigger difference on the overall outcome. So, no, you would expect cash funds and money market funds to have very, very low costs. Bond funds are typically cheaper than equity funds. But obviously, once you're in the world of equity funds, costs will often be higher if they're operating in niche markets or specialist markets.
Yeah, and
absolute return funds can have high fees because often they will include a performance fee structure. But the most expensive category overall would be fund of funds, because you've got the costs of the fund of funds and then obviously the costs of the underlying funds that they're invested in. So essentially you're paying two layers of fund costs.
Okay. And yeah, in fact, when I looked at the most expensive active funds, in fact, they were in these specialist areas, for example, specialist property or Asia-Pacific property. So that does kind of bear that out. But in fact, the OCF is not the end of it, is it, in terms of the charges you pay as an investor?
No, and this has been a hot area of debate, and it's something actually the FCA, the UK regulator, is doing further work on. Because that OCF, while it includes the charge that the fund manager makes for running the money and other sort of administrative expenses, the key bit that isn't included in that are the sort of trading costs that a fund will inevitably incur, the dealing fees that they will incur when they buy or sell shares. And so what the FCA is working on is a new formula for giving a very transparent view of all costs. And the problem with including trading fees is, of course, they can depend, you know, on, you know, just how busy the fund manager's chosen to be give over a particular time period. So it's quite a hard thing to predict, because there may be an environment where they find they need to do a lot of dealing, but they may have other years where actually the approach is very low turnover one because they're satisfied with the holdings that they have. But there is going to be more to come on that.
Yeah, and in fact, one thing I noticed when doing this research was just how difficult it is to find out exactly what is in an ongoing charge and what isn't. And research fees is an interesting one here. Some fund houses include them in their ongoing charge and some don't. And in fact, we have had several companies, haven't we, split out their research fees and kind of take them on the chin and not charge those to investors anymore. Is that something that you think is beneficial? Do you think there's a kind of lack of transparency there?
Well, there's always room for more transparency on my niche. I suspect, that the granularity of this is hugely interesting to a very small number of people. But most investors really just want to know, well, what's the overall cost time, that they're paying, rather than, seeing line by line, how that money is being spent. You're right, there are a number of firms have taken the decision that they will centrally pay for all their investment research rather than, bill it against a particular fund that they run. And I expect you'll probably see more of that happening because some players decide to do it, it shines a spotlight on those who are continuing to book those costs against particular funds.
Okay. Well, for a full breakdown of what's in your OCF and the cheapest and most expensive funds, take a look at the magazine this week. But finally, we're going to round up with income again. And Emma's been looking this week at private wealth manager Sanlam's latest roundup of the top performing UK equity income funds. So, Emma, what are the top performing funds this year and how does that compare to the last study?
Well, the funds with large weightings to small and mid caps performed very strongly in this edition, with the top three funds all having a lot in this area. So number one was CF Mitten UK Multi-Cup Income Fund, which has actually maintained its first place since the last survey in February. It has 35% in AIM-listed stocks, 18% in FTSE 250 companies, and 14% in FTSE small cap. Number two was Slater Income Fund, which also has more than half of its portfolio in smaller micro-cap companies. It came second, up from sixth last time, so an improvement there. And the fund that came third was MI Shelverton UK Equity Income Fund, which has a whopping 75% in smaller micro-cap companies. So it just shows how much these funds have done very well off the back of their small mid-cap exposure.
Yeah. Jason, what's the reason for that? Why have smaller companies been doing so well this year in income terms?
Well, the underlying earnings growth has been much stronger, not just over the last 12 months, but actually over the sort of the full five-year period that I think the study looks at when it's compiling its rankings. So, smaller companies and mid caps have actually had stronger earnings growth than the big large FTSE 100 companies. Despite the fact that actually, of course, a very sort of common theme over the last year since the Brexit vote has been a sort of preference by many investors to move towards large companies because they have those sort of international earnings. But on a steady currency basis, actually, both smaller companies and mid-caps have outperformed.
Okay, interesting. And Emma, does that mean that the converse is true and that funds with a weighting to large caps have underperformed?
Yes, in general, they have lagged behind those that had exposure to smaller mid-caps. As Jason's been saying, these have done very well in recent times. So, for example, the worst fund, which was the biggest fall in the survey, was Newton UK Income Fund. And it slumped from the sort of middling list to the list to consistent poor performance. And it has almost 60% in giant-sized companies and 23% in sort of large caps. So that's an example of a fund with a lot of exposure to large caps that has lagged.
Okay, interesting. Jason, we tend to think of smaller companies as being higher risk, don't we? Do you think that is the case or is there a bit of a misconception there?
I think there's a bit of a misconception there. There are many different ways that you can measure risk. One often used measure is volatility. Actually, in recent years, the sort of annual rate of volatility has actually been lower for smaller companies than it has been for the FTSE 100. Part of that is undoubtedly driven by the fact that we've seen a lot of volatility, in the sort of commodity and energy sector because underlying, oil, gas, and commodity prices have been so volatile. But you know, often you know, very large businesses, you know, can be quite complex because they operate over so many jurisdictions and are quite complex. Whereas actually, there's no reason in itself why a small business should be higher risk. They are, of course, often less liquid. So I think it really depends on the qualities of each individual company.
Okay.
One fear I think you know that we've seen over the last year is a lot of people worrying about smaller companies being more exposed to the domestic UK economy, and you know what might that mean if we have a difficult Brexit process.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I think that's all we've got time for this week. So for more on all of those income funds, pick up the magazine this week. And otherwise, catch us again next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.